You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, September 6th.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Tonight, four writers take the stage of the Bolton Theater at the Cleveland Playhouse to deliver their acceptance speeches for the 72nd Annual Annis Field Wolf Book Awards. Established in 1935 by Cleveland philanthropist Edith Annis Field Wolf, the award recognizes books that celebrate the rich diversity of human cultures. But along with celebrating human diversity, the Annis Field Wolf Book Award also recognizes authors who reveal the evils of racism. And such is the case for my first guest as we dedicate today's Around Noon to three of the 2007 winners. Martha Collins is a retired Oberlin College professor who delves deep into her family's past through the art of poetry. Her latest collection of poems, Blue Front, tells the horrifying tale of a lynching in Illinois and the little boy who witnessed it in 1909. Joining me now to share the details is 2007 Annis Field Wolf Book Award winner Martha Collins. Martha, congratulations and welcome to the Idea Center.
Thank you so much, Dee.
The little boy I mentioned was your father. I wanted to begin with having you talk about your dad and how you first learned about his story from this event.
One time when we were visiting Cairo, he pointed to an intersection in the town, and I was quite grown up by this time, and the main intersection, and he said, "I saw a man hanged there when I was a kid." That's all he said, and I think the image in my mind was an awful one of some kind of public execution. But it wasn't until 2000 when I saw an exhibit of lynching photography, lynching postcards, actually, in New York, that I discovered what he had seen. These postcards were pretty horrifying anyway, just as images of hanged people who'd been hanged and otherwise mutilated. But they were also souvenirs of lynchings. But they were horrifying to me as well because I saw a series of postcards from Cairo and realized for the first time that my father was only five, that there were 10,000 people at the lynching, and I realized what the circumstances of the lynching were. So I began doing research and did it for some time.
So if you were grown up at that point, then he was certainly on in age, but the image was so vivid for him still that that he had to remark on it. Was there any further conversation?
There was no further conversation. And of course I've thought often since then, why not? Maybe because it was one of those times when I wasn't asking questions. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, if my father had told me everything he could remember, I think the book wouldn't be what it is, because the real point of view in this book is trying to figure out what it would have been like to be my father as a five-year-old seeing a man lynched.
Mm-hmm. The title Blue Front comes from the Blue Front restaurant in Cairo,
yes,
where your father worked as a boy.
Yes.
Describe the time and place where the story takes place and how your father fits in. What was he doing there?
My father's uncle owned the Blue Front restaurant. My father's father worked in the kitchen, and my father sold fruit at a little stand in front of the restaurant. He could make change, and so people would come just to see him. They would try to trick him with odd amounts of money and odd numbers of pears and apples, and they never could. So they sold fruit just because he was so good at that.
How and when did you decide to write an account of what your father witnessed? How long after that one-sentence description?
Years. It wasn't until I saw this exhibit of the postcards. I bought the book from the postcards. I obsessed about this for a year. And finally, I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, about as far culturally as you can get from Cairo, Illinois, and I just started typing in things on the internet. I typed in lynching. I typed in Cairo, Illinois. I typed in Will, alias Froggy James, who was the primary victim of the lynching, and began that way, and then realized at some point that I wasn't writing a poem, I was writing an entire book. There was nothing else I could put in this book.
And I wanted to, since we're on that point, have you describe how you structured the book, because it's more than just one long, unbroken poem.
Right. Actually, I wrote it as I was learning things. It's fragmented partly because my own knowledge was very fragmented. I didn't know much. I knew the name of the primary victim. There were actually two lynchings, two men lynched. The primary one was an African-American man who had been accused of raping and murdering a white woman. And the lynch mob late at night, kind of as an afterthought, broke into a county jail, the county jail, and found a white man and hanged him too, though much more decorously than they had hanged Froggy James. But in the beginning, I knew what I found on the internet. I was in New Mexico. So I was writing sort of around the edges in the beginning, writing about the history of Cairo, writing about my father. It wasn't until later that I actually got to Cairo, where I went four times and did a lot of research. The librarian there was quite wonderful. Went to the Illinois State Archives in Springfield and looked up every account I could get my hands on of the lynching, and there were many in the state. So I actually got to the events of the lynching fairly late in the game. And what I knew was always in fragments. And even when I had completed my research, it was in fragments. The narrative sections themselves are kind of collages of various newspaper accounts, which of course are in some conflict. So constantly I'm writing with what I have. And frankly, what I was doing was I would finish a section and I would just put it aside, and the stat kept building up. And at some point I started arranging things. What I wrote first was the beginning, and I knew it was the beginning. Somewhere along the line, I wrote what was very nearly the end, but I had no idea where anything else was going.
And as I was thumbing through it and trying to get a sense of it, the structure sort of reminded me of fragments of music, a tune that sort of drifts into your head and drifts out, and sometimes repeats and comes back in different ways.
Yes. And that was, I mean, there was music in my mind. There always is. I'm a poet. Mm-hmm. But various lines became refrains to me. They kept coming back to me. And it wasn't as if I were writing and decided it was time to stick that line in again. It's just, here came the line again. And of course, I became very conscious of coincidence and similar things, and would use the line in a different way.
I'd love to have you share some lines with us now.
Okay, this is a section that comes about two-thirds of the way through the book. Cairo is the most southern town in Illinois, and it was very important during the Civil War. Many of Grant's early campaigns took off from Cairo, so that's alluded to here. The lynching itself, the black man was accused of raping and murdering a white woman. There were trees on those streets that were named for trees. Sycamore, cedar, poplar, pine, elm, where the woman's body was found, where the man's body was taken and burned. There must have been trees. There were trees on 7th Street in front of the house that stands in the picture behind the carriage that holds the boy's mother, the boy's cousin, the boy. And of course there were trees on Washington Avenue, wide boulevard lined with exotic ginkgos, stately magnolias. There were trees on that street that are still on that street. Trees that shaded the fenced-in yards of the large Victorian houses, the mansion built by the man who sold flour to Grant for the Union troops. Trees that were known to the crowd that saw the victim hanged, though not on a tree. This was not the country. They used a steel arch with electric lights and later a lamp post. This was a modern event. The trees were not involved.
poet Martha Collins reading from her latest collection, Blue Front, which is one of the winners of the 2007 Anisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction. Stay with us as later in the hour we hear from two of the other winners, Scott Reynolds Nelson and Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Meanwhile, Martha, is your father still around?
No, he isn't.
He was not at the time that you began this book.
No, he wasn't. Or I would have immediately gone to him.
Yeah. I was curious what kinds of emotions and feelings it brought up in you that perhaps you didn't have a place to deal with or to touch base about with someone who had experienced it.
Well, I actually ended up feeling much closer to my father at the end of writing this than I had ever felt. And of course, I don't know what he felt as a five-year-old. But in the process of writing this and trying to imagine what it was like to experience this, I just thought I came to understand him a little better and at least to appreciate who he was. And the end of the book quotes something he said to me, his final words to me. And even though the book in some ways talks about things about him that maybe he would rather not have remembered, maybe I should just read that little...
Please.
Can I read the section?
Yes.
This is the last section of the book, and this is about my father. And this is, in some sense, the way in which I've dedicated it to him. He wanted to know everyone. In the end, he was a kind man, did errands for old people younger than he, helped kids with school, met people in stores on the street. Please, may I help? And the last day he said, you know, this world could be a better place. Just promise me that you will help. He waited. He made change. May I help you, please? Make change. And of course, that last line is one of those echoing phrases that goes back to this five-year-old kid who was making change on the street.
And it's a great way to think about the words that you've written, too, because it's part of the reason that you're one of the winners of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award. I'd love to have you talk, too, about that award and what it says about making change.
I can't think of an award I'd rather have won. Of all the awards I have won or all of the awards I might have won, this one is most special and dear to my heart. The book, of course, when you're writing a book of poems, you're not thinking about what it's going to do in the world. You're thinking about yourself. But what it did for me was to change me, to make me much more conscious myself of my own place in racial history. Before I started writing the book, I happened to meet an African-American person who very kindly was asking me what I was doing, exploring sites of the civil rights movement and so forth, and as a white person. And I had a lot of answers to that. But the answer that I have now is it's my history, too. And the awareness that I've come to is that I think of myself now in racial terms. I'm a white person. White people often don't do that. It's a given. You don't think about it. And now I do all the time. It's part of who I am. And I hope that the book, I suppose that's what I hope other people are getting from the book and what I think this award honors.
And I want to take that just one step further before we go, because it doesn't just stop at thinking of yourself in racial terms, but beyond that, what does that mean?
What does that mean, and what do you do? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do? And that's why Make Change is at the end of the book. And, of course, I don't tell anybody how to do that. But certainly making change begins with awareness.
I'm curious if you're working on something else now along those lines, or if you've taken a completely different tack as a writer.
I have done a number of things since the book, and certainly this kind of awareness has gone into some things that I've done. I won't describe my current project exactly. I'm writing several longish poems. I don't seem to be able to write short poems anymore. But I'm also thinking about another project that has history in it, and I'm not close enough to that yet to talk about it. But I think once you get hooked on this stuff, it's very hard to leave it alone and just go back to writing small poems.
I could say the same for reading it as well. It's compelling stuff, and congratulations, and thank you for sharing it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Martha Collins, one of the winners of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award. Her prize-winning collection of poetry, Blue Front, is published by Gray Wolf Press, and it's out now in paperback. The Anisfield Wolf Book Award ceremony is tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse, and it'll be held before a capacity crowd in the Bolton Theater. For more on Martha Collins, log on to our homepage today. You'll find that online at WCPN.org, where you can also hear today's show on demand. Coming up, looking for an American legend as we go in search of the steel-driving man, John Henry. That'll happen as you stay tuned to this special edition of Around Noon dedicated to the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards here on 90.3 Idea Stream.
Sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. For the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange
John Henry, he could hammer, he could whistle, he could sing. He went to the mountain early in the morning just to hear his hammering, Lord, Lord, hear his hammering. Just to hear his hammering, Lord, Lord, hear his hammering. When John Henry was a little baby.
Welcome back. You're tuned to a special edition of Around Noon as we spotlight the winners of the 2007 Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. They'll receive their prizes tonight in a ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse. And our next winner is Scott Reynolds Nelson, the author of Steel Driving Man, John Henry, The Untold Story of an American Legend. The story of John Henry's famous and fatal battle with the steam drill is one of America's great tall tales, like Paul Bunyan or Pecos Bill. But in his new book, Nelson reveals the realities behind this American icon. Scott Reynolds Nelson joins me now in Studio 4 of the Idea Center. And Scott, welcome to Around Noon. It's good to have you here. And
thanks so much.
Well done for the prize that you have recently won. I want to begin with your first memories of hearing the John Henry story. Were you a little boy?
I was a little boy. I was in the Unitarian Church, and we were sitting around, and the way that the Sunday school teachers would try to get us to keep quiet was to play music fairly loud. Burl Ives' version of the John Henry song. We all got rocks and other instruments. We'd bang them on the chairs and played out John Henry there. That's where I first heard the song.
Did you know at some point beyond that he was a real person? Because I remember hearing that song as a child, and not until I think perhaps seeing your book, realizing that there was a real John Henry.
I didn't think there was. When I learned more about the story when I moved to Sanford, Florida, so a very rural part of Florida, and there the sort of John Henry legend was very much alive, and people talked about John Henry occasionally. And no, I just assumed that he was a legend. And in fact, when I started looking a little bit at the song, I had no illusions that there was any real person behind it. I was kind of astonished to find one.
Set the time and place where John Henry lived and tell us something about him.
Well, Virginia in 1865 is a helpful place to start. The end of the Civil War, the Virginia House of Delegates is reconvening all these white, mostly ex-Confederates coming together, and they create something called the Black Codes in 1865, which creates a whole collection of laws that are particularly harsh towards black people. And what happens is that the penitentiary quickly fills up with people who commit what are misdemeanors, or in many cases just interpretations of staying in a town overnight without a work pass or those sorts of things. And it's a grim place. It's a very impoverished part of Virginia near Richmond. And John Henry is a young black man, 17, 18 years old, from New Jersey. And he is somebody that becomes a kind of target of the sort of anger of some white Southerners about the conclusion of the war and how they lost it. And black men striding around like conquerors is something that they focus on. So the person who's John Henry may or may not have taken something from a small grocery store. It gets the case keeps getting transformed until it becomes housebreaking and larceny. And he ends up with hundreds of other young black men in the Virginia Penitentiary in Richmond.
How does he become John Henry, the steel-driving man?
Right. How does John Henry, the convict, become John Henry, the steel-driving man? Well, what happens is the Virginia Penitentiary is so full that no one quite knows what to do with all of these people. And the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad has a plan. And the plan is to build a railroad through the mountains of western Virginia. And they're going to do it with steam drills, and they're going to do it with dynamite. And these two new developments right around the same time, it's going to allow them to penetrate these mountains. That's their dream. That's the kind of fantasy that Collis Ponor Huntington and others have. And as they start to do this work, they discover that it's not working. The dynamite's doing just fine. Nitroglycerin's doing just fine. But the steam drills are failing and failing again. And Huntington happens on an idea, which is to take all the convicts in the Virginia Penitentiary and use them to do the drilling. John Henry's 5'1¼" tall. It's hard to imagine that that's somebody like that is going to become this legendary figure, but it turns out that that's the perfect size for drilling holes in the side of mountains. You want somebody who's small, compact, powerfully built to do this work. And so what happens is black men are working side by side. These convicts are working side by side with the steam drills, and they start to inhale the microscopic dust that's generated, and it gradually strangles them.
You hit the road to go in search of John Henry. Where did you go, and what did you find?
Well, I started with I had not planned to hit the road. I had not really planned to do anything about John Henry, and then I happened across this postcard of the Virginia Penitentiary, big White House in the center, and the last line of that song, they took John Henry to the White House. And they buried him in the sand, and every locomotive comes roaring by, says, "There lies a steel-driving man." And it occurred to me sort of in a flash that next to the old White House of the penitentiary was where 200 young black men were discovered, the bodies of 200 young black men, 17 to 22, were buried right after the construction of this tunnel. And so I started out, I had to do some quick talking in the Richmond State Archives to get access to the penitentiary records. And lots of people had written about the legend before, and they said that the engineering records of the CNO will never have them because they burned in a fire. And I discovered that they were available, and they were right here in Cleveland. The Western Reserve Historical Society had the engineering records of the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad that described in detail the convicts and the steam drills working side by side, and then the deaths.
That's an interesting circle that brings you back to Cleveland as an award
right.
winner, too. Also an interesting comparison between you and Martha Collins,
yes,
in that a postcard
right.
started
right.
this
Right, for Martha
journey.
And I, it's both a postcard. Yeah.
Your writing style is quite informal, as you talk about your dog and joke about your history students.
yes.
Why did you decide to start the book writing in the first person and in that kind of informal way?
I had written a book before about Klan Violence and Railroad, kind of a social history of the South after the war. And that's where I kind of picked up the expertise about railroads that sort of let me into the topic. And I had written it in a kind of academic prose that I had figured was going to was necessary to get tenure and to become a professor at William & Mary, and all that worked. And once I got tenure, I figured I could do whatever the hell I wanted to do. and so I said, well, you know, this all of this academic apparatus, I can put that stuff in the footnotes, but I want to tell the story the way I want to tell it. And so I decided to open up the writing, and what somebody told me, people aren't necessarily drawn to history, so you want to show them why you're fascinated by the character, and so show them your journey into the heart of the John Henry legend. And so that's how I started.
And it makes for a very engaging read. I'd love to have you demonstrate that now.
Well, thank you. I'm going to read the last page. Nailing down the song to a single interpretation is impossible. This is largely because John Henry died without leaving us a written testament, making his story almost infinitely mutable. The last words he is said to have spoken, "Cool drink of water for I die," are little help in letting us decide what his life and death was about. We need, finally, to grasp the entire song and story of John Henry, though it is a sharp nettle. We need to see it for all its complexity. It is a story of murder, and of the unnamed dead buried in the sand without gravestones. It is a story of the rage of a Yankee soldier with a terrible wound who consigned a black man to his death. It is a story of state laws that appeared just, but let Virginia's assemblymen cuff and slap down the black men who strode about them like conquerors, let them hurt the John Henrys who had seen haughty planters run away from the ramparts of Petersburg, had seen the planters surrender, had watched them beg for mercy. It is a story of Collis Potter Huntington's fantasy of transcendence by money and machinery, of magical steam drills, impossible shortcuts, and the real story about the men who got the job done. It is a story of a man robbed of his dignity and of his life, who in death claimed victory. It is a story of an octopus built and sustained by 40,000 aching hands and arms and backs, an octopus whose origins are remembered in the breath of 40,000 men. It is a story of women who carried the work forward in some of the darkest days of African-American history, of women who remembered and did the work of any man. It is a story that let people tell their own sorrows in the sorrows of another human being who lived and died. It is a blues story to chase hurt away. It is a story of the blind biblical prophet Samson, reborn to overpower the mighty Philistines. It's a story of the power that God could put into any man with a hammer, while letting him die a natural man. It is a story of the injuries that hide in tunnels, mines, and cotton factories, unacknowledged, ignored, and fatal as a bullet. It is a story of a perilous race to the bottom against impossible odds. It is a story about the ills of capitalism and Jim Crow, and about the power of revolution. It is a story about terrible adversity that somehow produces marvelous things, like a rumor that was terrible and true, a song. Even today, as those songs and stories are pushed down fiber optic pathways, they still travel along the paths laid out by the nation's railroads, along channels bored by John Henry and hundreds of other men like him. If John Henry's bones, first in the penitentiary and now at the Smithsonian, could speak to us today, he might have two words to share with us. Slow down.
Scott Reynolds Nelson reading from his book, Steel Driven Man, John Henry, The Untold Story of an American Legend. Tonight, Scott accepts his Annisfield Wolf Book Award at the Cleveland Playhouse. I'm curious about surprises for you along the way as you researched the book and did your travels.
Yes, there were lots of surprises. I think the one of them was certainly discovering that there were records that everyone thought had been destroyed, and I think part of that is that historians tend to follow paths that mostly folklorists had looked at this before, and sociologists, and so we tend to follow the sources in a different way. I had expected to find a more heroic character here. I expected to see something that was more heroic, but I think the surprise was me with me. I think it started with doubt when I heard the John Henry song. Other people had said, "Well, this is a song about a sort of character out of Ulysses. This is a character out of Homer. You know, this is a black Ulysses, a rambling black Ulysses who could." As a black man in the 1860s could command any amount of money for the work that he did. And what I knew about Reconstruction suggested to me that was a little problematic. And so when I heard the song, I guess I heard a much, much more disturbing song. It reminded me of what I'd read about the connection to the next writer, the sort of Igbo songs of the dead, just to appease the dead. And it sounded to me like a dirge. And hearing it as a dirge then led to the surprises, I think. The discovery of the postcard, the discovery of the man 5 feet 1 1/4 inches, and the characters who led him to his fate. One of the characters is the Freedmen's Bureau Commissioner. When I first sent this to the editor, she sent it back. She said, "You need to describe this commissioner to me. I can't really understand why he's so angry at black people. Why is it that a Maine Union soldier from Maine is so angry at black men, as he clearly is in these documents?" So I chased him down and discovered that he had a huge hole in his head, in his forehead, created a large fistula, and it was where had he gotten it from the First Battle of Manassas, and how had he gotten it? Possibly a man shot by his own troops. He was a Union officer who was hit with a mini ball. At a time, based on the way that the battlefield was laid out, he couldn't have been hit by Confederates who were were firing canister shot from 250 yards away. But he received a mini ball in the forehead, and I think it kind of changed this man, who was initially kind of like anybody else, who came to be angry about the war, and he blamed it on the black men and women for whom he understood that the war was about. So I guess seeing the characters there was enlightening and strange.
Yeah, and it becomes a story not just of this man, but of the time period that surrounds him and the country as well.
Right. It's such. I think it speaks to this a kind of an amazing African American cultural tradition that can take such a terrible story and turn it into a song about heroism and about an uplifting story. It's kind of astonishing that process is possible. And so you start with something that's. I have to say that the chapters 3 and 4 tell a grim story, and yet here's a story that becomes adopted by rambling singers, by blind blues singers, by the Communist Party in the 1930s. All of these people
take an oral tradition
and reshape that story and make it something that's kind of magical. Yeah.
Thank you for doing the same as well. It really a great pleasure reading this book, Scott, and a pleasure to meet you as well.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for having me.
My guest, Scott Reynolds Nelson, the author of Steel Driving Man, John Henry, The Untold Story of an American Legend. Tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse, Scott receives the Anisfield Wolf Book Award in a ceremony that begins at 6:30 in front of a full house inside the Bolton Theater. Steel Driving Man is published by Oxford University Press and available now in hardback. For more on Scott and his book, just log on to our homepage online at WCPN.org, where you can hear today's show on demand. Coming up, we enter the world created by Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie as we warm to horror award-winning novel Half of a Yellow Sun. That'll happen as you stay tuned to around noon on 90.3.
Well, he laid down his hammer and he died, Lord, Lord. Laid down his hammer and he died. Laid down his hammer and he died, great God. Laid down his hammer and he died.
It is 14 minutes before 1 o'clock as you're tuned to around noon on 90.3. The music you're hearing in the background was recorded in 1951 in a small town in Nigeria. It was the soundtrack of real lives lived at that time. But it could also underscore the imagined lives created in the pages of the award-winning novel Half of a Yellow Sun. That book takes the reader into Nigeria's small villages, towns, and bustling cities at a time of great turmoil in the country's history. The book's author is Nigerian-born writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and her moving portrayal of her homeland's past has won her this year's prize for fiction in the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. Chimamanda will accept her award tonight during the Cleveland Playhouse ceremony, and she joins us in Studio 4 of the Idea Center for today's Around Noon. Chimamanda, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations first on the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, but I should also say that you are no stranger to awards. Your first novel, Purple Hibiscus, won the Commonwealth Writers Prize for the best first book. I'd love to have you start by telling us some of the story that you were sharing in that novel and how it may relate to what you write now.
Well, Purple Hibiscus is set in Nigeria, more contemporary than this one. And it's really about a family. It's about religion. I was very keen to write about religion. So I have a father who is a fundamentalist Catholic and who loves his family fiercely. And I wanted to explore that difference between being righteous and being right. So he was fiercely righteous. And of course, my question in the book was he right? And so he would beat his kids and beat his wife, but also was a pillar of the community and helped people. And so, and in some ways also it's a coming of age. So his daughter, who's the narrator and observing him and their life, slowly comes to see that there are alternatives to the life that they lead and changes, I think.
In terms of your latest novel, there are echoes of the life that you've led. You lived in, grew up in the house of another Nigerian writer, Chinua Achebe.
Yes.
And I wondered if just being in that atmosphere had an influence on you. Of course, not as a little girl, I'm sure.
Yeah, You know, it's interesting. I like to say that I when I woke up to go to the bathroom at night, that I would hear the literary spirits whispering in my ear. But I really don't know that I was interested in writing. I've been interested in writing since I was old enough to spell. And so having lived in Achebe's house, really, for me, is just an interesting coincidence. And he happens to be the writer who's most important to me.
And because
his work gave me permission. Because before I read Things Fall Apart, which is his best known novel, I was writing stories that were very similar to the stories I was reading, which was British fiction for children. And so all my characters were white. They all lived in England. They had dogs called Socks, which of course didn't happen in Nigeria. And then I read Achebe. And then I read another book called The African Child by Kamara Lai. And it completely changed. I realized that people like me could exist in fiction. I really did not know that until then.
And that's actually one of the things that I love about this book, because it takes me to a world where I have not been, but I want to be sitting in that in that room, in those rooms with your characters, and as I turned the pages, I felt as if I was there as a fly on the wall.
That's what I hope to achieve. I think a number of books have been written about this period, Nigeria, Biafra, but I wanted to write about the ordinary people, and so I would read these books about accounts of battalions, and I wanted to know what they had for breakfast, and I wanted to know if the women they loved were angry with them. You know, I was interested in that. And so I wanted to write this book about ordinary people and also to show that, you know, war is a time when horrible things happened, and many of those did happen, but also a time when people came together. I mean, I heard so many stories of heroism and courage, and I wanted to show that as well, that people did come together. People found strength that they probably didn't know they had.
Before we hear something from the book, I want to have you set the scene of that time. You cover the period of the early 1960s to 1970, and what were the social and political backdrops that were going on for your characters?
I have mostly middle-class educated Nigerian characters. I start in the early 60s, and so it's a university town. There's an intellectual who's fiercely anti-colonial, pan-African, as were many intellectuals at that time. And I very much wanted to capture the spirit of a lot of talk about the glories of Africa and also a very strong pan-African sentiment. So these intellectuals were interested in Jamaica and Haiti and Mississippi and South Africa. And then, of course, I moved to the late 60s when things have started to sort of fall apart a bit, and people have realized that becoming independent didn't necessarily mean that Nigeria will then go on to perfection. And a lot of ethnic discord had become the case in Nigeria, and then which led to massacres of Igbo people who are southerners in northern Nigeria, which then led to the southerners wanting to secede and become an independent country. And that's why really the war was fought. But of course, the war really was about oil, because the oil was in the south, and so the rest of Nigeria was unwilling to let the oil go. And yes, and also I think it's important also that how much the world was involved in this. In this war, that
how much the world was involved?
Yes, yes. That Biafra, I think, Biafra actually, the Red Cross says that Biafra was its largest, apart from the Second World War, Biafra was the largest sort of work that it has had to do. And you know, the US, the UK, and how people in Czechoslovakia and in Greece and in Poland were donating money to save Biafra. How really, I think, because the world hadn't seen conflict on television, hadn't seen conflict in the newspapers until Biafra. That it became, and also I was reading about how the churches came together. So for the first time, the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches came together to fly in food into Biafra. So for me, that was interesting as well.
Please share something from the book.
Yes, sure. Baby was laughing at something Ugu said. Her pure high-pitched laughter made Olanna smile. Baby liked it here. Life was slower and simpler. Because their stove and toaster and pressure cooker and imported spices were left behind in Osuka, the meals were simpler too, and Ugu had more time to play with her. Mommy, Ola, Bibi called. Come and see. Olanna waved. She was watching the outline of the mango trees in the next yard. Some of them had fruit drooping down like heavy earrings. The sun was falling. The chickens were clucking and flying up into the kola nut tree where they would sleep. She could hear some villagers exchanging greetings in the same loud-voiced way that the women in the sewing group did. She had joined them 2 weeks ago in the town hall, sewing singlets and towels for the soldiers. She felt bitter towards them at first, because when she tried to talk about the things she had left behind in Osuka, her books, her piano, her clothes, her china, her wigs, her sewing machine, her television, they ignored her and started to talk about something else. Now she understood that nobody talked about the things left behind. Instead, they talked about the Win the War effort. A teacher had donated his bicycle to the soldiers, cobblers were making soldiers' boots for free, and farmers were giving away yams. Win the war. It was difficult for Olanna to visualize a war happening now, bullets falling on the red dust of Nsukka while the Biafran troops pushed the vandals back. It was often difficult to visualize anything concrete that was not dulled by memories of Arise, that did not feel like life being lived on suspended time.
The words of Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, reading an excerpt from her book Half of a Yellow Sun. That book is one of the winners of the 2007 Annis Field Wolf Book Awards, which will be celebrated this evening at the Cleveland Playhouse. And Chimamanda joins us in the Idea Center at Playhouse Square for today's Around Noon. What is the climate today in Nigeria? You go back and forth between.
I do, yes. We have a democracy now. I like to call it a democracy of sorts.
Of sorts.
But recently had a new president. So things, I'm hopeful about Nigeria's future. I think that we have a president who is better than the last president that we had, and who himself is much better than the dictator we had. And so I sort of feel hopeful about where we're going politically and economically as well, because now we have, things are looking up. There are lots of problems, and we still have, there's a lot of what I like to call ethnic misunderstanding, which I think is a result of the way that we were colonized, that a lot of that was set up during colonialism, and that it's going to take a while to break it down. But I think it will happen.
And you experienced the effects of colonialism growing up as well.
Oh, I did. I think that, you know, growing up, like I talked about reading the British children's books, growing up in some ways in a culture that taught you to devalue who you were and what you were. And so it was better that you spoke English. we were punished for speaking our languages in school, that sort of thing. And sort of growing up the daughter of parents who themselves were the first to really feel the impact of colonialism. My father was educated by missionaries. And in his case, I think it was even worse because you were directly being taught that everything in your past before these people brought you Christianity and Western education was horrible and evil. And I think did quite a bit to people psychologically.
I thank you for giving us all permission to experience the culture in its fullness. Really a great pleasure turning the pages of your book.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Thank you. My guest, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, is the winner of the Fiction Prize in this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. The ceremony honoring all of the 2007 winners, including Lifetime Achievement winner Taylor Branch, will be held this evening beginning at 6:30 p.m. in the Bolton Theater of the Cleveland Playhouse. The event is already at capacity, but if you'd like to get your name on the waiting list in case seats open up, you can do that by calling 216-615-7599, and find out more online at wcpn.org.